Selecting Kripacharya for guidance as his spiritual master, performed three horse sacrifices on the banks of the Ganges. These were executed with sufficient rewards for the attendants. And at these sacrifices, even the common man could see the demigods. Purported by Srila Prabhupada. It appears from this verse that interplanetary travel by the denizens of higher planets is easy. In many statements in Bhagavatam, we have observed that the demigods from heaven used to visit this earth to attend sacrifices performed by influential kings and emperors. Here and also we find that during the time of the horse sacrifice ceremony of Maharaj Parikshit, the demigods from other planets were visible, even to the common man, due to the sacrificial ceremony. The demigods are not generally visible to common men, as the Lord is not visible. But as the Lord, by His causeless mercy, descends to be visible to the common man, similarly the demigods also become visible to the common man by their own grace. Although celestial beings are not visible to the naked eyes of the inhabitants of this earth, it was due to the influence of Maharaj Parikshit that the demigods also agreed to be visible. The kings used to spend lavishly during such sacrifices, as a cloud distributes rain. A cloud is nothing but another form of water, or, in other words, the waters of the earth transformed into clouds. Similarly, the charity made by the kings in such sacrifices are but another form of the taxes collected from the citizens. But as the rains fall down very lavishly and appear to be more than necessary, the charity made by such kings also seems to be more than what the citizens need. Satisfied citizens will never organize agitation against the king, and thus there was no need in changing the monarchical state. Even for a king like Maharaj Parikshit, there was need of a spiritual master for guidance. Without such guidance, one cannot make progress in spiritual life. The spiritual master must be bona fide, and one who wants to have self-realization must approach and take shelter of a bona fide spiritual master to achieve real success. Verse of purport, we hear about another time in the history of the world. This time of many, many ages ago, many centuries ago, is not fantasy. It is actual history, but it's very different from our current state of affairs, as you can hear from this purport. A self-realized ruler who lavishly spends charity on his citizens, of course in Australia being a so-called welfare state, you almost have something of that, remnants of great rulers who look after their citizens for better or for worse. But here really the ruler is much more than a charitable government official. The ruler is something like the spiritual master of his people, as you can hear. So much so that the demigods are visible to the common man, to the common woman, when this very empowered ruler does his sacrifices. That we see all across most of the ancient world, the phenomena of god kings, Rajarshis, Rajarishis, the seer kings of the ancient world. We find them in ancient Egypt, we find them in a very limited extent in Greece, and we even had one in Rome. We would like to categorize even Marcus Aurelius, the great king. I mean, those of you are familiar with that emperor, was really a sage. He describes in his memoirs that when he was young, Although he was a Roman, he got Greek training. Greek training meant that you had to sleep on the floor and wear rough cotton and study the works of the philosophers every day. So he was practically living a kind of a brahmachari life. So that's what the brahmachari life means. So here you had an example of an age past, an age that has gone by, where rulers were trained in, at least in higher thought, and could really consider what is best for their citizens. And ultimately we know that what is best for the citizens is what is best for each individual, and that can never simply be restricted to the material side of one's being. What is best has to have bearing on our spiritual identity, or else it's not really good. Bhagavad Gita has a lot to say about Shreyas. Actually, that is one of Arjuna's questions to Krishna at the very beginning of Bhagavad Gita. He confesses that now, I am bewildered, I don't know what is my duty, I don't know what is Shreyas, I don't know what is the ultimate good. Seeing this world, seeing my duty, I am bewildered. But I'm surrendering on to you. You are now my spiritual master. And you, please guide me. In this verse we also hear, Srila Prabhupada makes the point, that even a king like Maharaj Pariksit had a spiritual master. Anyone who would be able to guide anyone must take direction from the spiritual master. Last night we were discussing verse 3 from the Sri Upanishad, and in that purport Srila Prabhupada gives the very nice example of how human life, quoting of course from the 11th canto, how human life is like a boat. Human form of life is like a boat. So you can just imagine the body being like a boat. If you were to turn on your side, something like a boat, traversing the ocean of birth and death, the path of Sagar. And the captain of this boat is supposed to be the spiritual master, the guru. And the guru, you see, without the guru, without the captain, even though you may have a very wonderful ship, you will not attain your destination. Actually, in our current setup, our so-called postmodern society, we don't even have a final destination, officially. There's no final destination. And that's very peculiar, because human life is something like a story. And that's why stories are always so attractive to any hearers, to any human at least. We're always interested in stories. We like stories because our life is so much like a story. But our current culture is such where we're living a story with no plot. It has no real plot, because there's no ultimate destination. There's no summum bonum. Srila Prabhupada likes to use that word, and so also did the ancients. The ancients were, and I'm not just speaking for ancient India, I'm speaking for all the ancient world, that was very important, to have an ultimate goal beyond this material world. To be able to align oneself physically and mentally with a higher reality, and not just the temporary, fluctuating nature of this world, somehow being due with something beyond. It's also interesting in this purport that Srila Prabhupada speaks about the demigods and their influence, their visitations to this realm. Of course, extraterrestrial visits are still taking place, and Bhagavatam contains many accounts of beings from other planets usually higher planets, sometimes lower planets that are involved in the affairs of the world. We can understand that that's probably also still taking place today to a greater or lesser extent. There's definitely influence of these entities, although it's no longer of such high quality as it used to be, perhaps because our consciousness are no longer trained to properly relate to them. It's interesting, these sacrifices, the fact that through sacrifice the demigods became visible to the common people, and this was through the agency of the spiritual master / world emperor. So in a similar fashion, that which is not visible to our common eyes and vision is made visible by the agency of the guru. That we find, see, our material senses are so limited. It's described, if you sit down and you do the calculations, how much of this material world can we see? You know, there's so a little sliver of the electromagnetic spectrum that we can see, or is visible light. There is a little sliver of the audio spectrum that we can hear, and there is also a limited range of smells that we can smell. If you do all the calculations, then one conclusion is that you are left with 0.0018% of what you are perceiving is actually there. Our sensorium is so limited that we can only perceive 0.0018% of what is out there of the material world. So that's very, very little. That's like if all of reality is a big wall in front of us, then that is something like the size of a needle in the wall. You know, how little of the material world we can see. So much is hidden. So much is hidden from our view. But still, we are so easily proud of what we see, and we feel that even though we can only see basically through a peephole, you know, some doors have a peephole, so when someone knocks at your door, you can just look through the peephole and decide if you want to open or not. Here you have a massive door with a very small peephole, and all you can see is very, very little, and then conclusions are drawn about ultimate reality, as if we can understand everything. It is say for example, you have two people who get lost in a forest, and they come upon a castle, and they walk into this castle, and they find that all the rooms in the castle are locked, and then they find one room. And they open the room, and it's obviously the room where the janitor stays, you know, the person that cleans. And they find a few books there, say a few Russian books. And then they conclude, yeah, this must be a Russian castle. This is obviously a Russian castle, and the people who live here are all floor sweepers. You know, it's a culture of floor sweepers. So that's very similar to what modern thinkers have done. They have simply restricted, or they've drawn conclusions from a very restricted picture that is available from their material senses. And according to that, they have built an image of reality, and they have prescribed that as the complete picture of the truth. As it's actually very arrogant that, you know, if certain formulas and theories make sense in my little world, then they must be applicable all over the universe. That's very arrogant. But that is exactly what our culture, so-called culture, is all about. not very interested in the process. You see, there is a process that the Vedas offer for enlarging that people, we could say. It doesn't have to stay restricted to such a thin view of reality that can be expanded, and for that there is a process given. And this process is not too different from what is experienced in modern science as well. We read in Bhagavatam about so many things that are beyond our sense perception, starting in this verse with demigods that visit this planet and have an influence here, up until, of course, the 10th canto, which is very transcendental, where you have the Supreme Personality of Godhead performing his pastimes with his beloved associates. That's even further removed from our sense perception. So this is a very specialized knowledge, but even in scientific circles, there is knowledge that is very specialized and beyond the grasp of everyday understanding. There are specialized fields like thermodynamics, like quantum physics, certain fields of genetics that are very specialized. And there are actually very few people who can really understand them. And just because ordinary people can't understand it and don't have the vision to appreciate, they can't look at the world in the same way as these specialists do, that doesn't negate the validity of those sciences. So in the same way, even though we may not be able to immediately verify the existence of extraterrestrial beings to begin with, and the activities of the Supreme Personality of Godhead in the 10th canto by our direct sense perception, by following the process and becoming a specialist, one can also achieve that. See, even the Western world has their temples dedicated to their science. If one goes to Saturn, for example, you know, if there's anyone here who's familiar with Saturn, Saturn up there on the border of Switzerland and France, it's a huge nuclear research facility. It's huge. It's actually a small town. But this small town is actually a huge machine, and one huge machine in the form of a town. And what you have there is a one huge particle accelerator. So what happens at CERN is that certain subatomic particles are accelerated by the use of electromagnetic energy to a great speed. You know, you've heard of a cyclotron. Maybe you know. So a cyclotron does that. You accelerate particles and then they smash them. It's a kind of perverted Sankhya. You know, Sankhya philosophy means to divide and cleave. So the Sankhya sages of ancient India, they used to penetrate into the nature of this world by taking it apart and examining its different constituent parts. So now this is something of what's happening at CERN on a much grosser scale, because they're not using their intellect to dissect the world, they're using brute force. So then they smash these particles into each other, and then they study the debris, and according to the debris they derive more conclusions about the nature of reality, the forces that shape our world. So that is something like a temple in one sense, because you have specialists working there. You know, you need to have initiation to do puja there. Like here, you can't just come in here and think you can offer arti to the deities at this temple. You need to have some initiation, you need to undergo a certain process. Similarly, we can't just go there to CERN and say, like, you know, we're going to now work with the ultimate forces in the universe, and we'll just turn on the machines and do what we want to do there. they're very expensive machines, and there's no way they'll let you do that. But also, you won't understand what you see. It used to be popular. I saw it on a few recent album covers of different artists. Those pictures, those images that are formed by the debris, they kind of look interesting, but it looks almost like tie-dyed art. You know, like when you tie-dye something, like all these bright colors. So that's what you get. You know, after they smash, you know, the different particles, you have the leptons and protons and the electrons and so many obscure particles that we haven't even heard of, gluons, they have these funny names, and you see all their paths there. It's something that you can't really make sense out of. At least the layman can't make sense of it. That is because the layman hasn't been trained. You find a similar phenomenon with if one of us who is not trained in the reading of x-rays were presented with x-rays. To us it may just seem like some tissue and bones like that, but it's basically meaningless. But to a trained doctor, a specialist, it's a whole different story. You know, if they have an x-ray of your lungs, they can tell that this person has been a heavy smoker or has been living in a place like Mumbai, where it's said that if you 1 day of living in Mumbai is equivalent to smoking 10 packs of cigarettes. That was some years ago, it's probably worse now. So a specialist is able to discern, seeing what everyone else can see with their senses, but in a different way. So this is something that the spiritual master offers. He's also such a specialist. And if one studies under such a specialist, one can also be trained to look at this world differently. We're not now speaking about transcendental vision, you know, a paranormal kind of vision. This is just seeing the self-same material world that we live in a different way. Seeing it through buddhi, through intelligence, as something that is emanating from Krishna and is meant to be used in his service. So this can be done by surrendering to the spiritual master. This is why it's so important, and why it's sometimes very difficult to follow the orders of the spiritual master, because the spiritual master is seeing in a different way. The spiritual master is seeing so much more. We sometimes are very enamored, like conditioned souls tend to get, with our own world and own experience. We think we know best, and we think we can trust that little peephole vision we have of our life. But the spiritual master's vision is much more broader than that, and much more far-reaching, and therefore more difficult to follow, because we don't see what he sees. Yes. So I am following in the footsteps of my teachers, who always spoke very concisely. So I'm going to finish here and ask if there are any questions or comments regarding this purport of verse.
Thanks for the explanation. I'm not clear on three things. The first is, the word sacrifice, what does it mean by sacrifice? The second is, what does it mean by three horse sacrifice? And what I think is, like, three horse sacrifice is not a huge thing. And how can such a small sacrifice bring the demigods, you know, and come and see, which seems to be a big thing.
Yeah. Well, okay, your first one, what kind of sacrifice?
What is a sacrifice?
What is a sacrifice? Okay, well, in the Vedic system of religion, and this is slightly different to the more Pancharatrika system that we now practice. The more Pancharatrika system is what we do here, we offer worship to deities. The Vedic system, the ancient Vedic system, when we describe ancient and later developments, it doesn't mean the one evolved out of the other one, or there's some kind of a process of evolution taking place. It's all part of the same system. the Vedic system of knowledge and even the Vedic literature is something like a tree. Yes, it begins as a seed and ultimately it sprouts into a whole plant or tree, but it's all part of the same thing. It's not different. So when you're speaking about these kind of sacrifices, they're not different from what we do here. They're not different from what one does when one chants the holy name. It's simply a case that certain types of sacrifices are more suited to the time, place and circumstance of a certain era than another. So about 3,000 years ago to 5,000 years ago, this phenomenon of fire sacrifice was very prominent. We even find it in the Old Testament. Those who are familiar with the Bible, it's like most of the Old Testament is about different pastimes of prophets offering different types of fire sacrifices. So a sacrifice is an activity wherein one offers or gives away something. Something that is yours, in many cases, you offer to God. It has to be to God to be a Vedic sacrifice. God or his representatives, the demigods. In a fire sacrifice, and there are so many different types of fire sacrifices, but you have a Yagya Kund, which you may be familiar with, and you have priests, and they chant certain mantras, the mantras of the Vedas, and that's largely why the Vedas are so ununderstandable to contemporary human beings. They're meant for the devatas. Don't try and understand Rig Veda or even Yajur Veda by yourself. Don't think you can have, you know, a copy of Monier Williams Sanskrit dictionary there and you're gonna like now I'm gonna read the Vedas, because the Vedas were meant for the demigods. The prayers, the suttas contained in the different mandalas of Rig Veda is meant to invite the demigods. So you know you're addressing them and they're coming. You know, it's not meant for your intelligence, it's meant in praise of the devatas, so then they are invited. And then you have the Yajur Veda, which describes more about the mantras used in the sacrifice, broadly speaking, they are vast. And then one has the Atharva Veda, which is used by, sometimes Atharva Veda isn't even recognized as one of the four Vedas. It has a bit of a bad reputation because it deals so much with black magic, you could say. So many spells, because the Atharva Veda priests, they had to secure the sacrifice from evil influences. So they would sit a little bit further away from this sacrificial fire where the other priests would sit, and they would secure the Yajna terrain from inauspicious influences. They would chant different mantras, sometimes to the planets, to pacify the planets. We hear in that pastime when Krishna abducts Rukmini, then as she was preparing for a wedding, the priests were chanting, the Atharva Veda priests were chanting to the planets to pacify the different planetary influences. So then the demigods come there, and then there's an offering made. And the offering is ultimately meant for their pleasure. In a horse sacrifice, a horse is sacrificed. And in the Vedic setup, that didn't mean that they would eat the horse afterwards. So that's where the sacrifices of the Vedas differ from that of the Old Testament. If you read the Old Testament, then they would always have like a kind of a barbecue, you know. It's there. It's also there in ancient Greeks. They would do that. They would like once a year specifically, there was this ox sacrifice, and the ox will come in into a sacrifice, sacrificial terrain, same thing, but of course without the Vedic understanding, and the bull would be let in, and then you know some incantations would be chanted, and then they would, you know, they would slaughter the bull, but also the bull didn't come back to life. So this is where the Vedic sacrifices differ. the animal that was sacrificed was rejuvenated. So you would have the animal enter on one side of the Yajna Kund and come out at the other end young, like a young, fresh version of the same animal. So that would be very powerful in demonstrating the efficacy of Vedic mantras, because now if you read about the Vedic sacrifices in Bhagavatam, you hear that they were the major events. Like now we have the World Cup, or you know, the Soccer World Cup, or cricket, or something like that. So then you have a whole arena full of people coming to watch. So similarly with these sacrifices, you had a whole arena of people coming from all over, not just earthlings, but also celestial beings coming to witness and to be present for Yajna. So that was so you can see how wonderful Vedic culture is, that even you have a religious function that's also entertainment to the masses. People come and they're entertained, and at the same time they get educated and they gain more faith in the Vedic process. You can just imagine if you go to it's almost like a magic show, because here you have this huge fire and you have, you know, all the priests, you know, dressed in you know, probably colorful clothes. At least their wives would be dressed colorfully, because for certain yajnas, your wife has to be present. That's very important. So they're dressed, you know, all the sages, they have their wives with them, and they're dressed colorfully. So it's like you have this the Oscar night or something like that, where everyone dresses up. It's like, so everyone would dress up and they would come to the yajna, and all these mantras would be chanted, and then the big celebrities will come, the stars will arrive, and that of course are the devatas. So you can imagine how much of inspiration that would give to the masses, that okay, we've been hearing about Ganeshji, and we've been hearing about Surya, we've been hearing about Durga, and here they are, ladies and gentlemen, it's Surya. He comes in with his Vimana, probably, you know, coming, you know, like a private plane, comes and lands, and then Ganeshji comes in on his rat. I don't know how elegant that would look. And all these celestial beings come. And so that's very inspiring. Okay, so we've answered two of your questions. The third one was,
why does that be, how can that sacrifice be, so that you may, like, at a given time, at a given era, and owned by someone?
Yes.
He asked, firstly,
what is a sacrifice, and what is a war sacrifice, and then how it was possible for demigods to appear simply by sacrificing wars. You see, it's not just simply sacrificing wars. You know, if we all go out town, we capture wars. You know, just put it on a bunch, you know, on stones. And we do like an old-fashioned Old Testament sacrifice. Like, then it's going to be, don't expect to see any demigods. You can expect to see the police or the animal. That happens in South Africa. In South Africa, we have this the indigenous people, and they do these animal sacrifices, especially this ox sacrifice as well. And lately, the animal protection services—they, you know—they stop these things. They think they're going to have some sacrifice, and then they come and they stop. No, you can't do this. That's out of the question. So why did the demigods appear there? Because of the mantras. The mantras are the same mantras that we still have. And we still have Rig Veda, Atharva Veda, Yajur Veda, Sama Veda, but now we don't have qualified people to chant them, qualified Brahmanas in this age to chant them. And it's one of the things that are restricted. Shishtani Mahaprabhu gave some Vedic Brahman to admission that, you know, in this age of Kali we don't do that. We don't do horse sacrifices. If you're there's a number of things, taking karma khandas in the eyes, and that's also prohibited in this age, like that. So It's the mantras that made the sacrifice. Yes, Guru.
So Janandriya, King Janandriya wanted you to finish all the sarpa, all the snakes.
Yes.
So why were you advised not to do the sacrifice?
Well, there's a from Bhagavatam we hear that the sages just felt compassion for the nagas and the sarpas in the universe. I mean, it's a very heavy this is a holocaust, really. It's the equivalent of a holocaust. Now, you know, you happen to be in a snake body and now your whole race is going to be wiped out. It's terrible. It's like we say we decide now we're going to all the Gujaratis. It's terrible. So that body has a specific purpose. The sarpa species, jati, has a function in the universe. It's a certain step of evolution of consciousness that a soul has to progress through. So you can't just take out that. You can't just take out the step. You know, it would have been excessive. A similar thing happens with Dhruva. When he becomes really upset with the yakshas, and he starts killing the yakshas, and he's just killing them. You see, there was one serpent was responsible for the death of Janmajaya's father. So there's no reason to wipe out the whole race of the snakes. You know, it's like, we have these occurrences. Because of one person's mistake, you want to wipe out a whole race. It's not so intelligent.
The other thing you mentioned, 0.0018, how do you get to figure? 0.0018.
Well, I looked at many Moonies, you could say, Western Moonies, things like that, and their calculations, because it's very difficult, because to make that calculation, you first have to understand what there is. You first have to know the limits of perception, and we don't really know. We don't really know. We can't understand exactly how. You know, we can't perceive all the waves out there, all the light waves, all the radio waves. It gets too fine for our perception. We don't know how far it goes, so it's very difficult to come up with a big number, you know, from which to work, and then to start calculating how much we see in relation to that. But this I took from a very conservative mainstream Western thinker. Was his understanding that we're looking at 0.0018% of reality.
Because even the small particles like viruses, it's very hard to see during electron microscopes.
Yes. So
you can see just on the top.
Yeah.
And then it further magnify, you can see micro particles, and nuclei, mitochondria, and those things.
Yeah.
And then genes.
Yeah.
Only Krishna knows
about genes. Only Krishna knows what's really going on in atoms. We can speculate. We can smash them to pieces and look at what's left, and then speculate. But what's really going on? What Brahma Samhita says, Krishna is in each atom. So now there's this word in the street is that they found the God particle. But it's not the super soul. It's not the super soul. Any other questions or comments? Yes, ma'am.
The perception of the soul in the spiritual world is obviously much greater than the condition of faith. What are the limitations? Are there any limitations also to that?
Definitely. Yeah, definitely.
Sorry,
Mataji asked that in the spiritual world, which is not the material world, are there any limitations to the vision of the soul? In other words, in the spiritual world, do we somehow approach omniscience, some level of knowing much more? Because the reason that we can't perceive so much of reality is because of the limitations that are imposed on us by our senses. So now take away the gross senses and you live with the soul. Now, are you now? How much do you see? How much do you perceive? Well, the soul remains minute. So there's always a limit. But then at the same time, our perception is always mediated by Krishna's energy. In the material world, we perceive through matter. And in the spiritual world, there's yoga maya, which is Krishna's energy, which mediates our perception. So, unfortunately, human beings will, or at least jiva souls will probably never become omniscient or never achieve such a state. But we can perceive what Krishna wants us to perceive. That's something that Madhvacharya also made a big fuss about, that we can understand as much as Krishna Allah wants us to see. So if he's really pleased with the jiva, he can make you see a lot more. So that's that's possible.
So at every stage, whether conditional or liberated, we see or perceive as much as we need to in our particular
space. Yeah, we can't. Especially in the spiritual world, because then one's vision is it's simply bhava drishti. You're simply seeing according to love, your relationship with Krishna. So you're not thinking about, you know, what atoms are made out of. I don't think you're even thinking about the material world at all. Maybe just, you know, the feeling like you had a bad dream if you think about the material world, like it's far in the background. But it's unlikely that in the spiritual world anyone is thinking about the nature of reality, all these Aishwarya type topics about the opulence and majesty of Krishna, because they're very absorbed in Krishna's sweetness and beauty, and they're thinking how they can serve Krishna's sweetness and beauty. So that's that's very different. That's a very different vision. Elaborately described. But again, Bhagavatam, as Madhuji just mentioned, at every stage we see what we need to see. And Bhagavatam specifically tells us enough of the universe. The whole universe is described. I mean, from the development of the embryo within the womb to the movements of the planets, the beginning of the universe, its evolution, and its ultimate destruction. So everything is, from the smallest to the biggest, the atom, everything is mentioned, it's all there. But it's described from a vantage point, which is that of someone who's approaching Krishna. Like we have this big debate in Cape, North Cape and Stellenbosch, where we have a preaching center about the statement of Bhagavatam, where living entities born of perspiration. You know, there's this one devotee, he was you know, freaking out his mind, you know. What is this? You know, living entities born of perspiration. Why is this? You know, it doesn't make sense. So the fact is that, because the Bhagavatam mentions living entities, they're born from eggs or, you know, from the womb. So in the case of And then respiration, which is weird, living in this kind of respiration. So you see, the fact is that a society that is focused on God consciousness, they don't need to know that there are microorganisms as well that are, you know, they're the ones who are, you know, breathing in sweat. You know, we don't need to know that to love Krishna. You don't need to know that there are parasites and other entities that lay eggs in your sweat and that they breathe there, and in that way you have living entities born from perspiration. That's not relevant. So in the same way, we like to attain God consciousness in this life, we don't need to know what's going on the surface of Mars. It's not, we don't need to know that, but our current society is placing high value on space exploration as if this is something incredible. And the way that that NASA speaks, if you go to the website, the other evening we had some slides and I showed some pictures from the NASA website, how they project the surface of the moon to look in 50 years or so. They want to establish a space station there, and they want to ultimately terraform. Terraform means to change the climate of a planet to that of Earth. So the plan is that we've ruined Earth, you know, we've like practically exhausted our planet, so now we just move on. We start colonizing other planets and we ruin them. You know, so this is a major, this will be part of the history of the future, attempts to do mining, interstellar mining. A contract has recently been signed for that. They're going to try and mine asteroids, because there are rare metals like platinum and other precious metals out there in asteroids. So they want to get that. So that's what it's really about. Space exploration, it's not about increasing our knowledge, in the sense of real knowledge. It is simply about increasing our ability to exploit the material energy. And so that kind of knowledge won't help your self-realization. It's simply an arsa. It's useless. There's no arsa, no purpose. So in that sense, then Bhagavatam describes all these things. But from the vantage point of someone who's interested in self-realization, not someone who's interested in interstellar mining or decoding the human genome code so that we can clone different, we can, you know, try and manipulate karma, these kind of things. So these things are described.
Actually, the reason I asked is yesterday an explorer came to the surface of the Earth in Russia. That's almost like one half of the building. And today also there was a prediction that a comet which is revolving around the Earth will pass 27,000 kilometers away from the surface.
Yeah, the Vedas describe comets and they have names for them. One major one is Dhumaketu. Dhumaketu is, it's in Vedic astrology, they trace the influence of Dhumaketu on a person's chart. And there's Guli, and Upaketu, Uparahu, so many like of these asteroids. And so the knowledge is there. It says that that Kalki's sword, Dhumaketu is Kalki's sword. Descriptions given, and Prabhupada explains that if you see a comet, if a comet passes by Earth, it's actually very inauspicious. He says it's something like when a police chopper comes looking for someone, you know, at night with a searchlight, it's looking. Someone has transgressed the laws of karma, and now, you know, something big is going to happen. It's very inauspicious comet. These celestial influences of that type are so auspicious.